Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews from Vox, the website for research-based policy analysis and commentary by leading economists. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Luigi Zingales, Professor of Economics at the University of Chicago. Luigi and I met at the American Economic Association meetings in New Orleans in January 2008, and we talked about his recent research paper called Who Blows the Whistle on Corporate Fraud? He began by explaining what got him started thinking about this issue.
The issue that interested me was trying to figure out how sort of major frauds come out. Because there is, unfortunately, not a huge economic return to provide bad news, and there's not a huge economic return to provide terrible news like the one of a fraud. And what motivated my research is that when the Parmalat scandal sort of came out, first of all, I was shocked that a fraud of that magnitude could last for 15 years undetected. So clearly there were a lot of failures, if that was possible. But even more so, there was this story that came out those days that a lot of employees were joking about the amount of milk that was sold to Cuba. Apparently Parmalat was using Cuba as sort of a settled-up account where they were creating fake transactions selling milk to Cuba. And if you just did the division of how much milk was sold to Cuba to how many people live in Cuba, you realize that people in Cuba were flooded with milk. And the employees were joking about that, but this information never came out in the financial press. And so people never sort of understood that. And it was funny that on the one end, we had a lot of analysts, we had Standard & Poor, we had all the sort of equity analysts trying to find the information. On the other end, we had people with the information, and there was a market failure. This information was not transmitted. And this market failure is pretty costly one because it took like 15 years and 14 billion euros of waste to arrive to that. So I decided sort of to do a little bit what the AFA does after every airplane crash, is that you go and try to find what went right and what went wrong. And so we focus on American sort of corporate frauds, major corporate fraud in the last 10 years. And we limit ourselves to the larger companies so that there's more information. Also, the frauds are more relevant because if there's a fraud in a small company, who cares to some extent? And we try to figure out how this news emerged the first time. And so the amazing thing of this very long and painful research is that the most obvious candidate don't work very well. It says the SEC discovered overall like 8% of the fraud. Even sort of the auditor that I in principle to be the sort of the first line of defense, they get, if I remember correctly, 15% or something like that. On the other hand, we have a pretty important role played by the media and played by the employees. In spite of the fact that in most situations, and I would say an exception, but in most situations, the employees have a negative return from sort of coming out with the information, they do seem to be quite important. Why I say in most situations? Because in the United States, there is an exception, which has to do with a law called the False Claim Act that says that if you are an employee or, well, it doesn't need to be an employee, but if you are a person that discovers a fraud against the government, you can bring a suit in name of the government, and you can get a percentage of the amount of money recovered by the government. This percentage varies between 15 and 25%, so it's a pretty significant chunk. As a result of this statute, more than $2 billion of fraud were discovered since the law was approved. And this applies indirectly also to corporation. If I am in healthcare, and so I deal with the government, and I overbill the government, that's clearly a fraud, and there is a return to the employees. And one thing that we show in the paper is that employees, not surprisingly, are much more likely to reveal those frauds than other frauds. So, in a sense, it's a very interesting idea because we were talking before about market failure. There is a sort of a way to create that market. If you provide an award for people to come forward, they do come forward. And when we start sort of looking into that, people say, oh, but of course this will create a lot of tension inside company, will create a lot of false claims and all those things. And when we look at the healthcare industry, we don't find evidence of that. We don't find that they're more likely to bring false claims, for example. We didn't do any in-depth study about sort of the climate in the industry, but there is no indication that this is like a less trusting sector to work in or whatever, because you can sort of report. So I think that one sort of implication of this study is that there might be one way to address this corporate fraud that has been addressing the states with Sarbanes-Oxley, and so a huge increase in regulation, another layer of regulation. Maybe the solution is to go the other way around and provide incentives for the market to work and provide this information. And the reality is that it's very difficult to find fraud, because it's like finding the proverbial needle in the haystack. And it's much better to provide people who work in the haystack to report the needle when they find it and give them a reward. And I think that that's one approach. Another approach could be to penalize them if they don't report it. And in fact, some of the people who report fraud, employees who report fraud, they report it because they want to dissociate themselves from the fraud that takes place in the firm, and they are afraid to be involved, either sort of from a criminal point of view, also from a reputational point of view, because, you know, it's not a good business card to say I worked for Enron in the last X years.
So really, the story is about corporate fraud going on much longer than we would ideally like.
Absolutely.
And to which
the
policy answer is to introduce more carrots and sticks, incentives and disincentives, which will affect people's behavior.
Absolutely. It's as simple as that.
Tell me a little bit more about the data you've looked at. I mean, how do you go about gathering the data on these issues?
So the issue, of course, in this type of things is how do you get a complete sample? And we decided to start from all the security class action litigation, which are put together in this Stanford database. Why did we do that? Is because basically every fraud generates sort of some legal follow-up. And all these were large enough firms. That's one of the reasons why we focus on large enough firms. All these were large enough firms to generate enough interest for people to sue. And so we started from that sample. And then the first thing we had to do is, of course, eliminate the false positive. This is, I think we're pretty confident that basically all the real fraud are in it. But of course, there are a lot of frivolous suit. So we started by eliminating anything that took place before 95, because there was a reform in the way you brought the derivative the class action suit. And then we drop everything that either was dismissed or settled for less than $3 million. And then we did some robustness check. If you count at 5 or 10 or 20, basically the results are very similar. So I think we're fairly confident that this is a pretty good, reliable sample of frauds that took place in the States during this period.
Now, countries have different regulatory structures, different sets of systems of incentives and disincentives. So are some countries better at uncovering corporate fraud?
This we cannot say, because the study is just a U.S. study.
Sure, but I mean...
But looking at one other aspect that emerged from the study is that, to use a popular sentence, it takes a village to catch fraud. And this is, it's not just the SEC or just the auditor or just the media. It's a combination of this. Very often, it's actually a short seller that tips the media, and the media tips the SEC, and they get back and forth three times before this come out. And this is, it's very dangerous. Suppose I have a very clear sense, to use a true example, that there is something fraudulent in Parmalat. You know, it's very dangerous for me to go and sort of write it publicly. I can be immediately sued. Even if I say it mildly, I'm harassed. In fact, Parmalat, shortly before was revealed as a fraud, filed with the SEC and the Italian SEC a suit against some people that were sort of diffusing false rumors. And of course, the false rumors were all true. But fortunately, the people who started those false rumors were vindicated eventually. But in the meantime, it can be very costly for a journalist, an analyst, or whoever. An Italian analyst allegedly was fired from his company because complaints about Banca Popolare di Lodi that turned out to be another fraud, and he like did it ahead of the time, and political pressure sort of got him fired. So it's a very dangerous thing to do.
So there's implications here for laws about freedom of speech.
Absolutely. It is interesting that there are differences. For example, the United States are much more tolerant in that respect than England. And that's the reason why all the Russian oligarchs sue newspapers in England, because England's are much more protective of the integrity of the person. I think that in the United States, unless you basically show that you malignly published something knowing that it was wrong, I think you're protected. While in England, I'm not a lawyer, but sort of my understanding is that as long as you say something wrong, you can be in serious trouble.
Luigi Zingales, many thanks.
My pleasure.